I'm Dan Masterson, host of Strategy Talk, where we take a unique view of world events. We report news as history. With me today is the editor of StrategyPage.com and well-known military author, Jim Dunnigan. Associate editor and syndicated columnist, Austin Bay, also joins us.
Welcome, Austin and Jim. I thought we'd talk a little bit today about the rearming of Russia. Jim, you wrote an article here lately about how the Russian government, and you know, led by Putin, is placing their budget on a higher level for their military items. Could you talk to that a little bit?
Yeah, what Putin has said recently is that rearmament is the highest priority, and he's doing a lot of things which to Westerners, especially Western policymakers and analysts, are strange and disturbing. From the outside, it looks like he's trying to put the Soviet Union back together. Now, this is where it gets less strange. If you remember back in the 1980s, I was tight with the CIA and, you know, all the people who have since retired. And we used to discuss who was really running the Soviet Union. This was after Brezhnev died, and there was also the tumult, you know, within the Soviet Union. Now, I wrote in a book, the whatever edition of How to Make War, that the Soviet Union was about to collapse. This was in the late 80s, and it turned out to be true. That was might have been just, broken clock being right twice a day. But anyway, you know, I explained why, and it was basically finance. And we joked with the CIA crowd, because many of them agreed with me, that, you know, the problem with the Soviet Union was their best talent was going into the secret police, namely the KGB, and to a lesser extent, the military. They had these research institutes, you know, in cities that technically didn't exist, where they were treated very well. But they didn't have an environment in the West where people of talent have an opportunity to do something productive with those talents. You know, I mean, granted, we joked in the United States, many people went on to become lawyers, but many, many more, you know, did go into engineering and science and what have you, and business and entrepreneurship and what have you. Soviet Union collapses. And we noted it in Strategy Page, you know, early on when we started, that a lot of this talent was now free to, you know, basically flourish. And they did. But the old KGB people, the ones who didn't defect, who stayed in Russia, basically started taking over, eventually, in the form of with Putin as their front man, as it were. He was a career KGB officer. They have basically taken over. Now they did two things. One, and this is what makes Putin very popular in the Soviet Union. They restored order. In the 90s, it was chaos. Because there were too many people, you know, grabbing and not enough people trying to organize the chaos. And Yeltsin was basically an alcoholic, you know, he'd basically give a rousing speech when he had to. When Yeltsin was out, Putin came in. Now, he basically worked his way up the civilian, you know, ladder, as it were. And he immediately began bringing in his old KGB buddies. Now, he was a guy that basically exiled, as it were, out of work in many cases, KGB people, you know, could identify with. He was one of them. And it was basically openly discussed in the Russian media, a lot of it got into the English language media, that they were basically going to try and reinstitute the essential organs, as they say in Russian, of the Russian state. They basically meant the Soviet version of the Russian state, but, you know, they played that down or played it up depending on who they were talking to. And they've done that, but they've gone one step further with this nationalism of harkening back to the old, empire, which was lost when the Soviet Union fell apart. And Putin is basically jumping through different hoops. In other words, what's the shtick of the day Mr. Putin. It waves back and forth. But the one thing that's constant is the need for order in Russia and defense against foreign enemies. Now, of course, their biggest enemy historically and geographically is China. China is basically, they've made peace with China, literally and, you know, figuratively, in the last two decades, and at least since 1999. And they basically accused NATO of all sorts of nefarious things. Now, we're seeing this being played out now in Ukraine, where they're, the Putin version of history is that what's going on in Ukraine, the unrest, the unhappiness with the government, it's all a NATO plot. You know, it's like in the Arab world, it's a very popular, conspiracy theory that ISIL, was invented by the United States to keep the Arabs down. You know, we've heard things like that before. But the interesting thing was all this stuff about it's the West's fault, this comes right out of the old Cold War KGB playbook. You know, they accused the CIA of creating AIDS. We've all heard the stories if we reach far enough back in our memories. You know, we tend to forget unpleasant things, but if you think hard, oh yeah, that's right, they did. And they, and when the Soviet Union collapsed and people could come out and talk for a while anyway, we had people say, confirm it. They said, well, of course, yes, I worked with the directorate of this, the directorate of that. We were in charge of coming up with convincing theories about it's all the CIA or America's fault and what have you. But they're now doing it in Russia, but it's different now because Russians have tasted, modern life, as it were, and they're getting pushback. And now, I mentioned in that article this week, recently they basically enacted a law, which they had to debate for months and months, making it illegal to even talk about the peacetime military deaths, casualties, because the word was getting out of Ukraine about all the non-existent Russian soldiers that were there and getting killed there, apparently over 1,000. One Russian organization, which is now operating illegally, went and documented simply by going to the family, saying, was your son, was he a volunteer? Was he a conscript? And his body came back, and it was combat, his wounds, the sealed casket, and what have you. Putin was climbing the wall because this information was not only there, they could either disappear the body or send it back in a sealed casket. They decided it was probably less trouble in the long run to send it back in a sealed casket. A lot of these caskets were opened and examined. And so now he's trying to, make it outlawed. Now, of course, he's going to end up arresting some parents and putting them on trial because they're their dead son, which is going to go over real well. So they are basically running on thin ice the way the Soviets had not done since the early 1920s when there was a civil war going on between the Bolsheviks, the communists, and the anti-communists. This time, though, the anti-communists are not royalists. They're basically people who just want less corruption and better government, which, Putin would like to deliver, but in the meantime, he's got to pay off his cronies, he's got all this crony capitalism and what have you. So what we have going on in Russia is a very similar situation, to what happened, say, in the 1930s, where a dictator trying to, basically put back together a empire, in that case Germany and, Italy and Japan, started coming up with the same stories about the external enemy. We're victims and we have to fight for what's ours by right. Of course, this time it's different, A, because it's not so people have a living memory of what went on in the 30s, and then Russia has nukes, which makes it scary. And of course, we all know Putin has not been shy about saying, I could always use nuclear weapons. That scared everybody, not as much as he had hoped. But now he's saying that, we might have to invade Ukraine in self-defense, and tanks don't need visas, and it's all these other little jokes. Now, these people laugh in Russia, but a lot don't laugh. Now, they don't get much media play because the media is controlled by the state again. But what you have is the same thing happening all over again. It's that old saying, history doesn't repeat itself, but it paraphrases itself constantly. So this is what we have to worry about. We have a guy here deliberately trying to, start World War III. We all thought World War III was the Cold War, which is over and the West won, but it really wasn't. It was just, sort of a phony war, as it were, like that period between World War I and World War II. The real war might be coming, or as they say on, Game of Thrones, winter is coming. And the White Walkers are basically these old, scary stories of avenging defenders of the Reich. This is very real. Actually, it's going on in China too. Of course, we always talk about China because it gets people's attention. But the Chinese are doing the same thing. But the Chinese seem to be a lot more adult about it, you know, than the Russians, who are basically more desperate. They have less to work with. Their main weapon is fear, and they're using that as much as they can. The Chinese realize that they have numbers, they have money, they have a more robust economy, and they have more respect for history. Putin has none of those, and that makes him dangerous, very dangerous.
Austin, your thoughts?
Well, you know, let me pick up on some things. Jim's given a really good and broad summary of the issues. As for reconstituting the Soviet Union, the edition of A Quick and Dirty Guide to War, the so-called post-Cold War edition that Jim and I were putting together in 91. Remember, the Soviet Union officially collapsed on December 31st, 1991. That was a trade paperback that Morrow published that came out in 92, right, Jim? I think it was the summer of 92 or something. We get a study in there. You could see, we're talking, still calling it, you know, quote unquote USSR, you know, and Russia, but where was it going to go? And in the potential outcomes, one of the things that talked about in the quote unquote Russia chapter was at some point there would be a revival of Russian, you want to call it supranationalism or imperialism. There are all kinds of ways to express it. And you would begin, someone would begin trying to put the pieces back together. And it mentions in that edition, I'm doing this off the top of my head, Dan, but I gave a talk on this, actually. I want to say 2007, 2008. So I'm still doing it from some memory on that. But talking about some of the essential pieces, and that would include Belarus and Ukraine. Certainly Ukraine, because of its agricultural capabilities and agricultural assets and population, Slavic population, Belarus, white Russians, and a couple of the former quote unquote Muslim SSRs that had natural resources. So in the late 1990s, as I recall it, I was given a talk at a Rotary Club, and I said, well, you know, it's Russia, Ukraine, Belarus, Kazakhstan, and that's the core of a revived superpower. Because you've got assets, you've got population, and as Jim's latest analysis of Russia that's on the strategy page as of yesterday, I think, it talks about the terrible decline in Russian population. The Russians need people. Well, this was even evident in the 90s. And I said, well, you know, that's Russia, Ukraine, Belarus, and Kazakhstan, Rubik. And it kind of got a laugh. I remember passing it on to Jim after that, and he thought that was kind of funny. I used Rubik, as in Rubik's Cube, you know, putting the puzzle back together in a column, one of my Creator Syndicate columns, and it's up on strategy page in 2004 when the Orange Revolution in Ukraine was occurring. You could see that this is something that if you want to if you want to be in a position to have the quote unquote prestige of a real global power, as the Soviet Union had, they're gonna need those assets. Now, just for what it's worth, let me add this. Got a nice attaboy in 93. I was walking on and pulling one of my reserve tours at the Pentagon, and a fellow I know who worked in one of the analysis shops at OSD, I bumped into him, we were chatting in the Pentagon. He says, oh, by the way, Austin, I read that update of Quick and Dirty Guide to War that you and Jim Dunnigan do on the Russia chapter. We did some of our own war gaming, and yeah, somebody's going to try to do that to rebuild the elements of a superpower. That's pretty good outside work. So, it's nice getting that kind of feedback, but these are things that you could see were possibilities. Now, the thing is, it took a leader in a group that would want to pursue what is, and I'm going to use a fancy word here, Dan, but as Jim will tell you, it's one that carries a hell of a lot of dangerous historical baggage, irredentism. The irredentist claims of the Italians, you know, these lands belong to us. Hitler was an irredentist. It sounds like we're dealing with bad teeth, but we're not. And what happens in like my column this week talked about the Poles in Latvia, Lithuania, and Estonia. They're some of the fragments that the Russians think, not necessarily Poland, but certainly the Balts. And they sure don't like Poland being uppity in Moscow. But the Baltic nations are Russian satraps on the Baltic Sea. Well, these Baltic nations don't see it that way. And the irredentism expressed by Putin's clique in the Kremlin is a threat to their sovereignty and a threat to. A threat to their identity. They think they've got their own. they've got their own rights. They're also now members of NATO, which puts them under NATO Article 5. That's the Three Musketeers clause. If they're attacked, everybody in NATO is committed to take action, to include armed action against the attacker. But note, too, that the Balts and the Poles aren't 100% sure that the United States is committed to defending them like we were to defending Western Europe when the line went to divided Germany. So the drive to reassert Russian power is one of Putin's huge political and propaganda appeals. As Jim brought up the grievances, you know, the thing is, oh, we've been wrong. Well, look, that's one of the oldest shticks in the book by the, sometimes it's legit. Often when you, certainly the 20th century experience was dictators using it as a way to unify their own nations and then to launch aggressive wars. And Putin told us 10 years ago, maybe it had been 2004, 2005, that he thought the biggest tragedy of the 20th century was the collapse of the Soviet Union. The old KGB colonel wants to revive it, and he has built a domestic power base, both on grievance and on the dream of rebuilding it. And I'll make one other comment, too. Jim brought up nukes. Boy, is he right. That sure got a lot of attention throughout Europe when Putin rattled the nuclear saber, and that was what it was supposed to do. But there's an irony in this, too. Satisfying Russia and the ability to maintain large nuclear stockpiles and the like, and Ukraine not having them under their own control, that was the trade behind the Budapest Accord of 1994. The Ukrainians would give Russia the nuclear weapons that Ukraine possessed after the end of the collapse of the Soviet Union, and Russia would guarantee Ukraine's territorial sovereignty. And in late February of last year, right then and there, Putin shattered that agreement. Of course, he's got an entire range of agitation propaganda to blame fascists in Ukraine, and as Jim said, blame NATO and blame the United States. But he's the one who tore that. Now, when you hear some of his apologists and read some of the Putin trolls that are out there on the web, by the way, the first comment on my column this week is from a Putin troll. There's no question about it. They hit it. It hit it real fast. Is that, those were Russian nuclear weapons. Well, the Ukrainians have them. There was a trade. Oh, Crimea belongs to Russia. Well, you can punch that by saying, well, why didn't it belong to the Turks or even to the Pontic Greeks? And then another one that I talk about, historic Russian claims to Ukraine. Okay, but Ukrainians dispute that. What Putin did was undermine the diplomatic framework that tried to stabilize the old Soviet republics in Eastern Europe with the collapse of the Soviet Union. So he's destabilized it. He thinks it's in his interest, and no wonder he's getting the counter-reaction he's getting from Eastern European countries.
Now that you mention that, Austin, I think we should bring up the fact that those the 50 Cent armor, the trolls, the paid trolls. We've done several articles on that. Actually, we've done articles on that for almost a day. But listeners of this podcast who are also frequent strategy page, you can actually get involved in this neo-Cold War because on the message boards, as Austin mentioned, I get sent, you know, the feed, as it were, of all the traffic, and I zip through it and whatnot. And it's pretty interesting the way, you know, most of our posters are fairly bright, and they're not as trollish and, you know, as 4chan-ish, as it were, as posters are on other, you know, boards, mainly because we have a moderator who will throw your ass out real quick if you basically disturb the peace. Scott does allow these trolls to basically go on as long as they make a little sense. But it's interesting to watch how they're swatted down and how they're forced to basically work for their 50 rubles or whatever. They get paid pretty good. I mean, they get paid about 20% more than the average salary. So if you're an educated guy who's out of work or in between jobs, they literally have an office in Moscow where you can go there and sign up and what have you. And it's a job. It's a full-time job. And it used to be, you know, as we explained in some of our articles, it used to be done by volunteers at home, but China and Russia have organized it and basically turned it into another branch of the bureaucracy, the information ministry, or I guess we should call it the Ministry of Truth, to give Mr. Orwell his props. But here's if you want to get personally involved, you know, if you're willing to be reasonable and basically give these guys something that'll ruin their day, like the truth and rational analysis, Strategy Page also provides that as an unadvertised, you know, bonus, you know, feature.
Hey, listen, Jim, I don't know how quick it was afterwards because, I get some of the comments as well, but some Strategy Page readers swatted him down and swatted him down hard, you know.
That's what I mean. I've seen it. I monitor some other, you know, forums as it were too, especially ones that feature a lot of Strategy Page content. I mean, not that they're stealing it, they're quoting it and discussing it. And I must say that our Strategy Page, you know, posters are much better at it, you know, than some of the others. Actually, some of the other people on other forums, they aren't as well informed as it were, or as, you know, basically talented in, you know, dealing with this sort of thing. Some of them just, you know, troll right back. And it turns out, you know, it turns into a mini 4chan. For those of you not familiar, 4chan is where a lot of the hardcore trolls, you know, behavior started, or where it basically is seen in all of its malignant glory. But these guys are fairly well educated. I mean, obviously they can converse in English many times. And you can see it in the posts on Strategy Page. Apparently they have their A team on Strategy Page because these guys, and I deal, you know, a lot of our contributors are from, you know, not many from Russia, but from Eastern Europe and what have you. And English is a second language, and I spent a lot of time, you know, cleaning up their prose. But these guys, you know, the 50 ruble army, as they call them, anyway, there's a lot of names. These guys are generally, you know, just barely getting by in English. And they only basically send in the first, you know, the A team, as it were, to sites they consider particularly important. And of course, the most valuable of the 18 people are the ones who can express themselves very well in English. And that's the ones we're getting. I mean, in the old days, you know, 5-6 years ago, we were getting guys who barely could speak English, you know, write in English. But now we're getting, you know, the guys who are basically pretty good and they have a pretty good grasp of the information. And our average, our reader, as it were, considers them, you know, a form of entertainment. You know, let's see how many ways he can twist himself out of this one. And a lot of them just go away. I mean, so we're beating some of their 18 people. So we're definitely on their radar. And I'm waiting for the DDoS attack, which will, you know, I suppose ultimately arrive when they get totally fed up.
Hey,
yeah.
Jim doesn't want to.
Let me interject something here about this. We've got plenty of stuff on strategy page, and it's reflects what Jim just said. But yeah, folks will have to look for it. Google for it. But Voice of America had an interview with one of these folks several months ago. I'm doing again this off the top of my head. The fellow quit. And they also, I think, Anonymous quoted a couple of other people who had done this. And some of their operations, as Jim said, are quite sophisticated. They will come in and make the initial an A team member or even a B team member will put in something angry, and then they'll carry on the conversation to try to suck somebody in. So they use some pretty sophisticated methods. Unfortunately, we've seen them replicated in some political forums here in the United States as well. So,
right. Yeah. I think I've been reading Eric Schmidt's new book that's been out a little while on the new digital age. And those of you, you know, it sounds like it's all about new technology and like that, but the first part of the book actually covers the cyber warfare and like that, and about how authoritarian states and terrorist states and like that are going to be using propaganda on the internet more and more and organizing it better and better as time goes by. And so people are going to need to be able to filter in their minds and go to other places and get the straight scoop. And hopefully one of the places is ours. Over 40% of our visitors here on Strategy Page come outside the United States. So, and that's been a trend that keeps going up. I would imagine in another couple of years that'll be close to 50-50.
Yeah, but Dan, those are the Chinese cyber brigades, aren't they?
Right.
Well, the Chinese basically started, oddly enough, like many bright ideas, it came originally out of the United States, where early on it was discovered you could use the internet. This is where the internet was basically invented, so to speak. Not to take anything away from Mr. Lee over in Switzerland. It proliferated here, and it was America. I was involved in some of this. You know, then on Wall Street, analysts were telling me, hey, this internet thing is great for marketing, and yada, yada, yada. I began to hear the stories about how people were organizing, you know, basically 50-cent armies to sell products. The Chinese picked them up on that very quickly, and they were the ones that taught the Russians or showed the Russians how you could basically turn it into a branch of state disinformation and propaganda. And the Russians have taken to this, you know, very adroit, and they're putting a lot of money into it. Because if you basically offer money, you know, pay, a lot of people who basically, you know, got nothing better to do, or you know, their only talents are basically the ability to write, you know, comprehensively and, you know, comprehendingly in English, say, oh, well, that's an ideal job. I get paid to troll. Hey, you know, what can go wrong? Dan is right. You know, people are going to have to educate themselves, because in many other forms, like Facebook, for example, a lot of people, you know, swallow these, you know, baited hooks, as it were. And then you start seeing these Russian, you know, fantasies proliferating, you know, especially in leftist circles. You know, they attract a lot of people with, you know, how should I put it, overly optimistic, you know, pronouncements and promises and what have you. It's always been that way for centuries. And but with the internet, you know, you basically get a lot more of these ideas being easily planted by professionals. And a lot of the professionals are not from, you know, General Motors or you know, or Coca-Cola. They're from China, the Chinese government, or the Russian government. And a lot of people are still learning how to tell the difference. You're right. It's becoming a big problem. And, of course, in the United States, there's a lot of, with another presidential election coming up, I think you'll see more the media picking up on this. And when I was working for NBC back in the 90s, I brought this up a couple times. It was just beginning, and they didn't really jump on it because it wasn't big enough yet. But now it's gotten big enough where I think they'll want to go in there and go after it. I think a lot of the mass media, especially in the United States, which is more polarized than it's been in the last 50 years, are a little dicey about touching this because they use it, their advertisers use it. And, of course, during an election cycle, their biggest advertisers are political. So, you know, it's one of these, oh, we'd love to touch it, but, you know, and when they tell, when they say to me, you know, I know. They say to other people, you know, they say, well, what? But that's the way it works. So it's a very powerful weapon, so powerful that a lot of people are unwilling to even talk about it, even in a democracy.
Right. And in the United States here, there have been some firms that have taken and a look at where some of the rabble-rousing in the United States has come from, where it seems like there's a huge outcry and hue for against someone or something, and sometimes they trace it back that to it's only 10 people involved.
AstroTurfing, they call it in political circles. Well, yes, this is where the marketing came from. And, of course, interest groups in general have learned that if you can make enough noise. Now, having lived in Manhattan for 50 years, I'm familiar with this. We call it street theater. But a lot of people realize that if you want to get attention, this is the place to do it. And of course, as new technology comes along, there are new opportunities. And these opportunities are being exploited as we speak.
And there are actually programs and ways to make yourself look like, instead of 10 people, to make yourself look like 2,000.
Indeed, indeed. And even politicians are slow to catch on to that.
Right.
Dan, let me make a couple of points. I know we're running
we're going to wrap it up fairly quickly.
Jim brought up, you know, Putin's background as a KGB professional. He's a KGB colonel, and he was deception and propaganda he used those techniques every day during the Cold War, and so the internet and the trolling fits right in with some of the techniques that he learned as a young KGB officer. But secondly, there are also ways, as you mentioned, and I mean you're the IT guy here, but and software guy, but there are ways to penetrate those. AstroTurfing, as Jim calls them, because I'm aware of thanks to the internet, of a couple of cases where people who have experienced this have had the pockets to go back and have people trace it back, and then as Jim said, they find it's 10 people, 9 people, and they know who they are. They got their IP addresses, and they're exposed. It's going to be interesting to see how the U.S. courts handle it.
Right. Well, and it's going to be interesting to see how our government deals with some of this coming out of other countries. What are they going to do to try to expose it? That, in fact, the New Digital Age mentions that as one of the challenges for democracies is how do they go about exposing this stuff yet not looking like they're just the same thing that they're trying to expose. So
it's a dilemma.
Yep. Well, we'll wrap it up there, and we'll talk to you gentlemen later.
See you guys. Bye, guys.
Goodbye.